What is the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis? To explore this question, I am joined by Kerry Gibson, a clinical psychologist and researcher in trauma and youth mental health, and by Zubaida Mahamidi, who is an adult psychiatrist with a special interest in maternal mental health. Just want to acknowledge this profound time of disorientation and disruption. And New Zealand has been through some very traumatic events, the Pipe River mine disaster in 2010, the Christchurch earthquakes 2010-2011, Whakaari White Island 2019, the mass shooting at the Christchurch mosques in 2019, now the pandemic, COVID-19.
What do we mean by a kind of crisis or a trauma, and what are those kind of situations that you described, what do they have in common? I think the starting point here is that people have been exposed to circumstances which are, we would consider to be pretty distressing and perhaps even overwhelming for most people in and of themselves. It's not really about any particular person's vulnerability or something they're especially sensitive to, but these are events that would pretty be upsetting for most of us. Of course, those situations you describe are also quite different in lots of ways. You know, you've got the sort of once-off horrific event of the Christchurch mosque shootings, which happened in a discrete period of time and obviously impacted on people after that. But it was more like a kind of an event. And what we've got now with COVID-19 is something which is a sort of unfolding trauma, a kind of a crisis time, if you like, in which people are continuously being stressed by new demands, by the unknown, by threats to their health in an ongoing way. So all of these things are kind of trauma.
First of all, I might start by asking, what is psychological first aid?
Basically, when we think of psychological first aid, it came from a recognition that the kind of way that people respond to those situations immediately afterwards, in the immediate aftermath of a trauma, or indeed during the trauma, while it's happening, while people are dealing with these difficulties, that the way that people respond to that can be crucial in influencing people's recovery. And we find that if people are able to respond in helpful ways, that actually people get over these situations much more easily. The analogy here would be general first aid, where somebody has an injury and somebody rushes up in the moment. They don't have a huge amount of equipment, they don't necessarily have extensive medical training, but they're able to do what is necessary in that moment to kind of settle the person, to deal with the medical emergencies, and to get them in touch with the support or other resources that they need to carry on. So we borrowed that analogy and we're kind of using it now for psychological issues. So that's really where it comes from.
So this was introduced in the mid-20th century, where we were looking at people who had been exposed to a crisis or disaster, and then it was expanded to include disaster responders post 9/11. And the entire principle is aimed about first do no harm, but also about basically fostering adaptation in patients or people, and also about being able to offer some kind of care and formalizing good common sense at the end of the day. And it would be looking at activities that any sensible, caring human being would offer to someone else in a similar situation.
So just thinking about psychological first aid as one of a number of responses psychologically and socially for people, who can deliver it? Can it be learnt by anyone?
We can say that it can be learnt by anybody. It can be delivered by anybody. I think the first and foremost thing is to understand that there's many guidelines around psychological first aid, and they all have similar elements. And the elements around most of the guidelines are safety, calming, connectedness, self-efficacy, and hope. And what we want to say is that this does not need to be delivered by mental health professionals, but rather be looking at people who might be community responders, volunteers, clergymen, teachers. And I think what's far more important, even before we get there, is if you feel that you are capable of being able to deliver this, then you can do that. And the training can be offered online. There's various forms of training by the WHO, various Red Cross agencies as well.
A lot of people do this anyway. As you say, it's a kind of a common sense thing to do. I mean, it's the best form of common sense in the sense that it's sort of empathic and kind and thoughtful. But in many situations, it's the ordinary person, you know, it's, as you say, it's the teacher in the classroom. It's even the family member with their elderly aunt who's having to help out and kind of settle them in a frightening or crisis situation. And so this is not a kind of highly professional intervention, although it does have some kind of strong evidence behind it. It's really giving you a bit of a framework for just knowing what kinds of things might be helpful to say and do when somebody's in a state of distress. And it's not a set of absolute rules, but it's a kind of a guideline for how to be.
And one of those elements is safety. What are ways to help and promote a sense of psychological safety?
Firstly, safety from a psychological perspective. You want that person to feel that you are caring, that you are empathic, that you approach them with respect, respecting their dignity, but also about being culturally sensitive in that arena. Once you are there, you also have to think about how to maintain privacy and being able to ask, maybe not necessarily ask, but being able to approach certain aspects sensitively in terms of the trauma that's there. Simple things, introduce yourself. Let them know that you're just there to help. You may not necessarily need to talk. You do not need to pressure them to talk. It is just about being able to listen, maintain eye contact. I think, you know, a very humane thing is about offering to just hold someone's hand. And that is something that we cannot do in an environment like COVID, which makes it even more difficult to offer that empathy in that situation and that caring. And I think if you just be able to maintain that contact and show your caring and empathy, that grounds that person to be able to connect with.
Yeah, so that safety originally came from the idea that if somebody were in a sort of a disaster situation, an earthquake, that you made sure that, you know, your very first priority is that they should be sitting somewhere safe where their life isn't in danger and your life isn't in danger. But an extrapolation of that, as Zubeda said, is really that feeling of psychological safety. And, you know, when you're doing face-to-face work with somebody who's in a trauma, we even try and get them into, you know, you might be in a very chaotic situation, but maybe you try and find a quiet corner where you can pull two chairs together and sit quietly. Think about who can hear. Think about, you know, whether there's a little bit of silence around you. It's not always possible. And of course, COVID is bringing all sorts of challenges for us here, because so much of this sense of connection and safety that we get from a connection with somebody who's speaking to us personally and cares about what we're going through. We used to do that face-to-face, giving somebody a cup of tea, taking their hand, you know, making sure they're sitting comfortably. And when you, as is often the case with COVID-19, you're having to work through digital communication as we are now. All our Zoom communication, or whether it's instant messaging or texting or whatever kind of digital communication you're using, there's still ways to kind of do some of that introductory stuff and make sure that people are feeling safe and comfortable. You can literally say things like, where are you sitting now? Is that an okay place for you to be sitting? Hi, I'm Kerry, you know, tell me about, you know, where you are at now, and you know, kind of do some of that initial joining that makes people safe. And people think when it's digital that you have to get straight into the resolution of something, like transmitting facts. Particularly, say, in email, for example, people forget all about the relational connection, but it's so important, and you can communicate that via digital media.
We spoke also about the element of calming. How can we help calm people in order to reduce their distress?
You want to be able to get the person to focus on the here and now. Sometimes it is about being able to say, what you're feeling is completely okay. It is okay to feel overwhelmed, anxious, uncertain of what's going on, maybe a little bit confused. What's next? And sometimes even feeling a little bit numb and detached in the situation. Acknowledge those feelings. It's okay that that is happening. So first to be able to acknowledge that that's okay, that it's happening, and then to be able to say, all right, how now can I just connect and come back to being where I am here and now? And sometimes it's about saying to that person in a calm tone, making that eye contact, and simple things like focus on five things around you that's not distressing. Looking at grounding, even if it's placing your feet on the ground, and just being able to feel where you are in the here and now.
I think it's quite important not to provide false reassurance. So, you know, what Zubeda is saying is absolutely right here, you know, that it's about, it's kind of validating what the person is feeling. Like, yes, it is, you know, it is feeling overwhelming right now. Or this is a difficult situation to kind of tolerate. Rather than, you know, it's kind of often when we face with somebody in distress, we want to sort of rescue them. We want to make it better. And we want to come in and say, look, it's going to be all right. It'll be better soon. And say with COVID-19, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out. We don't know where things are. And so to say, yeah, it's really difficult to deal with this level of uncertainty. So you can bring some reassurance in, but it needs to be authentic reassurance, things that we can reassure about. Otherwise, it sort of becomes empty. A lot of people do find deep breathing, diaphragmatic breathing very helpful in calming them down, but you have to be pretty careful when you're meeting somebody for the first time. You don't know what that means to them. It can be quite frightening for people, for example, who are have physical health problems to breathe deeply, especially as you can imagine with some of the symptoms of COVID-19, breathing deeply may not always be the best thing for somebody in a state of distress. So I wouldn't jump in there straight away to kind of offer these sort of magic solutions. It might be better in that case to say to somebody, look, this helps some people. It's certainly not a, you know, an instant solution for everybody.
It might be a good time to talk about some caveats of psychological first aid, the notion that you're not that person's therapist, so you're not providing therapy. Do you want to elaborate on that?
I think that's important to understand that, firstly, you do not have to be a mental health trained professional to deliver psychological first aid. And you are not there to relive the events that have occurred. You're not there to process their emotions. You're not there to debrief them. So what you are there to do is to listen primarily. You're not there to pressure them to talk at all, and it is about being offering information, emotional care and support during a time of distress.
So we've been talking about some of the key sort of features of psychological first aid, and we've spoken about safety being tremendously important as a starting point, and then helping people feel calmer. Probably one of the most important things is to create a sense of connection with a person, where they introduce themselves, say who they are. Culturally, there might be things that you need to do there to make people feel more safe and comfortable for Māori and Pacifica, for example. A karakia might be helpful there. But also kind of then helping them to connect to people around them that can support them. So one of the very first questions I would be asking of somebody in a state of high distress is, who would you normally talk to about this? Are they around for you to talk to them? Is there a way that I could help put you in contact with them? So it's not even the professionals in the first instance that you want to put people in contact with. It's really the people that they love and that they often turn to. And those people can be more helpful sometimes than professional help in those early stages.
I'm just aware that there may be some people who don't speak very much about their emotions or, in fact, avoid them. So how could we advise on plugging into someone's emotional state?
We all have an innate sense that pushes us towards empathy. And I'm just drawing on my perinatal training here. Rizalasi, I think, describes something called the mirror neuron system that is about our ability to read the emotions on other people, and that gives us an understanding of their internal state. And I think that if we can think about our own feelings in that perspective and tap into our feelings to be able to understand what somebody else is going through. That gives us that capacity for empathy. And that allows us to be able to talk to people and make that connection and to be able to say, I see what you're going through and I can feel it as well. And that's very important. And once again, it's about that connectedness, making that eye contact and being supportive and being genuine. That's what you're there to do. You're not there to make any false promises. Don't commit to doing things that is not within your reach, but keep to what you can actually do in that situation.
And also just kind of being respectful of the way that people want to deal with something in that moment. So some people are very expressive and they want to talk about their emotions, and then, you know, then it's good to make a space for them to do that and to listen to what they want to say and let them know that you're hearing it.
So from a practical perspective, I think, you know, when you see the person, it is about understanding what are their current needs. And, you know, you need to ascertain what is it that you need in this moment. And it might be a simple thing like, I need to know where I'm going to live tonight. I need to be able to know what my financial situation is. Or I just may want to be able to contact my loved ones and let them know I'm safe, or finding out whether they are safe.
That also links to, you know, one of the other key features of a psychological first aid approach, which is really to sort of give people a sense of efficacy, which is a sense that they can do things, that they can reclaim control. One of the things that these traumatic or crisis situations do to us is they make us feel very powerless and helpless, which is one of the reasons why they're so frightening. And so we help people reclaim their own sense of being able to kind of do things. So in those examples Zubeda was giving about, you know, what somebody might want to do, like I need to let my family know I'm safe, I would say not, okay, I'll go and do that for you. But I might say, well, you know, how would you normally contact them? You know, would you need a phone? You know, here's a phone. Would you like to do that? I would let them do it because that allows them to feel like they're taking charge of something again. And we also know that one of the things that really, really helps people in this kind of situation is helping other people. It gives you a sense of purpose and also that sense of, you know, efficacy that I was talking about. So to have people, you know, in those waiting times while they might be waiting to see whether their loved one is okay or where they are or what's happening, well, is there something you could do? You know, are there people around you that you could be supporting or helping? Could you be making tea for your family while you wait, or for other people in the waiting room? Is that something that would work for you? So just explore ways that people can act. And I mean, we see so much lovely stuff around that is happening at the moment, you know, in communities and neighborhoods around New Zealand, as people are helping each other. And of course, they are helping their neighbors and all the people who need their help, but they're also helping themselves in quite powerful ways. So, you know, that's something to bear in mind too.
It's pretty clear that people do need support and resources to get back to some sort of normal. Can you suggest any supports that might be helpful to access?
The people that you probably want to talk to about how you're feeling in a crisis are the people you love and the people who are around you. So I really want to emphasize that. There's so much value in talking to those people who know you, talking with them about what you're feeling, but sometimes just talking with them about anything gives you that sense of sort of connection that can help you through. So professional help is really when you're feeling that's not working for you, or you don't have those kinds of resources available for yourself. In our current situation, the most obvious one is to go with the 1737 helpline number. The risk when somebody's in crisis is that you want to throw all kinds of resources. Try this wonderful website. Here's this, here's it. When people are in crisis, they literally can't take in that kind of information. So one simple piece of information, here's a number you can call. They will tell you what your options are. You know, they can get you to a mental health service. They can talk to you on the phone, and preferably write it down, because in a crisis, again, people don't remember.
The texting of the numbers 1737 is a good idea, but also to understand that you need to direct them towards reputable information. So with us, it is about the Ministry of Health at this stage. So even if it is just to guide them to the Ministry of Health website and to say you're going to get a lot of information there that you might require. But if you need more help, there are other resources that will, like Healthline, that you can call if you are concerned.
And also, people have got a lot of needs with food, housing and finances and so forth. So accurate and timely information about those sorts of things would be helpful as well.
Absolutely.
Just wanted to ask you about this idea of boosting mental health literacy, because psychological first aid is but one way to do that. And as a public health tool, I suppose, but also in terms of thinking about the increasing awareness of our own emotional well-being and that of others, and how to foster that self-efficacy and hope that you mentioned.
It's very important, firstly, to let people know that what they're going through is normal. It will pass with time. Often it is with good family support, good community support, or support in general that allows you to get through. And I think the synonym of psychological first aid being community-based psychosocial support is very important. And I think that just taps into the model of well-being that we have, but that community support that is really so important. And I think that community support is what gives us that ability to identify our capabilities and to know that we can move forward and to be able to get through things.
There's been a big emphasis on sort of professionals as a source of support for people. And I'm a clinical psychologist myself. Zubeda, you're a psychiatrist. Part of our job is to provide support to people in distress. But I think it's so important that we don't just professionalize that. That's not very helpful. I think one of the most important things I would want to say to people, I think, is that you actually have the power to kind of support people around you with your kindness, with your empathy, with your understanding. This is not rocket science. This is the stuff of ordinary, humane, interpersonal interaction. And we're asking people to use their own common sense with that rather than simply waiting for a professional to tell them what to do.
The aim of psychological first aid is to reduce that initial distress and then to foster that person's function in an adaptive way, which I think is a really empowering sort of message of hope that anyone can be present with someone.
The people doing the helping in the situation in COVID-19, but also around some of the other traumatic situations we've had to deal with in New Zealand, are also themselves subject to the same circumstances. So if you think our helpers are not outside of this stressful situation that the person being helped is in, and so this, we really have to also be mindful of the stress that all the helpers, whether they be formal helpers like us as professionals or informal helpers who take up that role in their communities and families, that the kind of stress that they're carrying for themselves, and to make sure that they also caring for themselves and being kind of gentle on themselves, not taking on too much.
With the COVID-19 pandemic, we're going to be facing this in so many ways. We are a shortage of psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health care professionals in general. It's a shortage throughout the world. So we want to be able to say that as a community, we can offer something. There's so many opportunities for us to be able to intervene and just offer some kind of support and care.
Well, thank you to you both, to Kerry Gibson and Zubeda Mahamidi, for helping me explore this question of the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis. And thank you to our audience for listening.